Protein folding problem. I know, I'm sure most of you have heard this phrase. We bandy it about a great deal. It means at least two different things, though. Most commonly, it's used to mean, how is it that a sequence of amino acids encodes a unique three-dimensional functional structure? But the other thing it can mean is how it is that a floppy polymer chain that does encode a unique structure can find that unique structure in a biologically relevant time frame. And it's that latter question that my group is addressing. Now, from the perspective of my chemistry colleagues, this can look like a very trivial question because it's just a conformational change. Small molecules undergo their conformational changes very fast. So, cyclochemist's version of cyclohexane has two primary conformations available to it. Random thermal fluctuations kick it back and forth between those two in less than a nanosecond. So, searching conformation space to find the global minima is very rapid. Protein folding, again, is just a conformational change where a random coil polymer finds its single unique native state. But if we apply this sort of interconversion rate to this problem, right, by counting up how many configurations are available here, we come up with a rather nonsensical answer for what the predicted folding rate is, whereas the experimentally observed folding rates are somewhat faster than that. I always like to emphasize this point because I still think that actually this naive model that I first presented is not an unreasonable model. It's just a conformational change. We know the rates with which molecules search through conformations. We know how many conformations are available. Seems like a perfectly plausible model, but it's wrong by about 50 orders of magnitude. And very few things, well, there are very few models in biology that fail that spectacularly. I don't know about physics. I always like to look for things that fail so spectacularly, right? Because the answer that we're searching for, how is it that this process has been sped up by 50 plus orders of magnitude, is not going to be a subtle answer, right? We're not looking for a factor of two kind of speed up. I'm not a very details-oriented fellow, but for me, even for me, 50 orders of magnitude doesn't seem like a detail.
It would only be for us.
You know, I'm not even sure if that's true, Fred, right? Because, so we actually just did an experiment, with Paul Hansma, we did some experiments where we actually finally, for the first time, experimentally determined the conformational entropy of this unfolded ensemble. And it turns out each monomer in the polymer chain has about 9 configurations available to it, now experimentally measured. Well, so for a 100 residue protein, which is a small one, you know, 9 to the 100th power is a super astronomically large number, right? I mean, we beat the astrophysicists, we beat the pants off of them, right? These are much bigger numbers.
No, string theory is pretty
Okay. Okay. So we beat, that's right, that's right. We beat astrophysicists, but not string theorists. Those are always my favorite.
I mean, couldn't you say the same thing for, you know, taking some water molecules and making ice?
Absolutely, you know, always true, right?
So in fact, water molecules.
In that room next door, I had a rather vociferous argument with a large group of theoretical physicists about this very thing. Absolutely true, right? Freezing of, you put a glass of water in the freezer and it is so entropically, so extraordinarily unlikely that all the water molecules line up, it should take much longer than the age of the universe. So that simple theory is wrong by 80 orders of magnitude. Why? Same here. Same with protein folding. The simple theory that I just wrote is clearly wrong, but I want to know why. What's the mechanism? For ice freezing, it's nucleation.
Since I actually belong in the other room, I don't completely understand the rationale. Because if you took a whole bunch of your first system, the simple one, took as many of those, it would be comparable in size to the complex one you have. Then you could repeat your argument for that simple one again, and you also come up with 10 to the 40 meters or something. But in fact, they all do it in parallel, independent.
So you're arguing that a potential solution, yeah.
A complex system must, you know, it must be some kind of independence from one end to the other, right?
That is, that, great. There's, you just hypothesized a mechanism by which this kinetic conundrum is solved. And I'm going to,
yeah.
Well, you know, a potential way of breaking down the complexity of the search and preventing it from being fully rendered. Yeah. We'll get back to that, right? So first hypothesis anyone's come up with here in the room is that it's a hierarchical process, or where maybe hierarchical, maybe partial. Maybe this part folds, and they come together. And I'll definitely address that. Really quickly, let me show you how it is as an experimentalist. We study protein folding kinetics. By the way, if you want to know what protein folding experimentalists look like, it's those guys over there. They look like surfers, don't they? So conceptually, our experiments are really easy. We take a protein from some bacteria. We chemically unfold it. We put it in conditions where the unfolded state is favored. And then we rapidly transfer it to conditions where the folded state is favored. And it takes some time for the new equilibrium to be achieved. So we'll take some protein unfolded at low pH, high temperature, with various chemicals like urea. And then we very rapidly transfer it to conditions where the folded state's the favored state, typically by rapid mixing, by diluting away whatever the chemical is that causes it to be unfolded. And then we monitor spectroscopically the various properties of folded proteins as they evolve. I'm sorry, Tom, could you grab me a glass of water? Thank you. For these rapid mixing experiments, we're typically limited to how efficient our mixers are. Millisecond, really good mixers, tens of microseconds. So that's most of the experiments we do are that way. If we want to push to faster time scales, we can do temperature jump experiments, or we can do various equilibrium experiments like NMR line shape analysis, right, where you're encoding kinetic information in equilibrium observations.
And these mixers, if you have very strong flow, can flow influence unfolding
process? We can make mixers that will mix in 10 microseconds. Turns out when you do that, though, you're subjecting these unfolded polymers to so much shear stress that you've got an artifact from the relaxation. And just between all of us, I think that artifact has been published as real data in a number of recent papers. Not everyone realizes that. So what is it? But as I'll show you in a minute, it turns out, thank you. More than I'll need, but thank you. That's a flower vase, isn't it? is the water fresh? So, as you'll see in a moment, it turns out the time resolution isn't really an issue here. It isn't going to be an issue here. And we've got lots of spectroscopic probes and non-spectroscopic probes. We can monitor basically every property of a native of a folded protein with reasonable time resolution. That's a great shawl. The formation of these elements of local structure, secondary structure like alpha helices, packing and hiding away of certain amino acids, formation of stable hydrogen bonds pinning together the bits of polymer, every aspect of the native state of the folded state of a protein, we can monitor with the requisite time resolution. Now, historically, what happened when we applied this battery of tools to the folding of larger proteins, what was seen was that you were at least partially right. So folding is a hierarchical process. You go from an unfolded ensemble, you very rapidly form elements of local structure. These elements of local structure collapse to form relatively condensed globules, but they aren't quite packed correctly. And then these elements of structure shuffle around until they find the correct final structure. And so again, we've broken a single enormous entropic barrier into a bunch of coupled barriers. All right, where the unfolded state forms these local elements of secondary structure, which sometimes for these proteins are stable. And therefore, while this is entropically costly, there's some other energetic payback. And similarly, these collapse very greasy surface area that wants to be out of water. There's some solvent entropy payback for that just that overcomes the polymer's entropy. And thus, again, we've broken one big barrier into a bunch of little barriers and sped up the process by many, many, many orders of magnitude. So this is how it looked back in about 1990. By about 1990, every protein that anyone had looked at had seemed to have this hierarchical folding process. But then in 91, Ellis First group at Cambridge published what I think we now realize is a fairly groundbreaking paper characterizing the folding of this protein. It's a very meaningful picture, isn't it? It's a small 62 amino acid protein. It's a protease inhibitor from barley, for what it's worth. The important thing is it's small. It's a single structural unit. It doesn't have any complications. It doesn't bind metals in the way some proteins do. It doesn't bind other prosthetic groups, as we call them, as some proteins do. No covalent crosslinks in the chain, so it's only a single continuous polymer chain. It's much simpler than any protein anyone had characterized previously. And what they showed was that the folding of this protein, unlike all previously characterized proteins, is very well described as a two-state process in which you've got a single barrier that's jumped over. Yeah.
They deduced that.
Next slide. Right. But before I get on to that next slide, let me give you the disclaimer. Right. Clearly, this model is wrong. Folding cannot be a two-state process because we're not tunneling through the folding barrier. You must have partially folded states. But this two-state approximation appears extremely accurate, suggesting that all of the partially structured states here are unstable relative either to the unfolded or the folded states. So we don't have this downhill hierarchy of structure that's pruning the search tree, if you will.
Or you just can't resolve.
It's not a matter of temporal resolution. This thing folds relatively slowly. We've got all the time in the world to look at it. It's a matter of population resolution. We don't see them building up. So we know they're all relatively poorly populated and thus relatively high in energy. That's what I was saying before. It turns out it doesn't matter so much what our time resolution is. No matter what time resolution we have, this will always look two-state. But if we had sufficiently good spectroscopic probes that we could see one part in 1,000 this structure, maybe we'd see it. But that's still, the point is that they're all high in energy. So it's not a downhill guided process. What's the evidence? Well, actually, lots and lots of evidence. I'll just give you a little bit. So, it's not boring. If intermediates were building up, well, intermediates have different properties than the starting material, right? And so some properties of the folded protein would evolve faster than other properties. But here's one protein, one of these two-state folding proteins that folds relatively slowly. And so we had time to monitor by NMR the loss of unfolded material, the recovery of native material. This is sort of the recovery of native three-dimensional tertiary interactions. This is a recovery of local structure, local secondary structure. This is recovery of the packing of the aromatic side chains in the core. This is a recovery of removing one of the amino acids from solvent, and in this case, we've even got recovery of biological activity. And they're all occurring with identical kinetics. Usually I blow off the disclaimer, though, but with this crowd I won't. Sure, Tom's looking at this and saying, but that's not a single exponential, right? This model says everything should be single exponential because there's one barrier. That's clearly not single exponential. One complication in folding kinetics. Proteins are comprised of 19 amino acids and one amino acid, proline. The difference being that in proline, the side chain comes back around and covalently attaches to the backbone itself. So it's structurally different than the other amino acids. Because of that, the backbone of proline occurs in two states, trans and cis. The interconversion of those is rotation around a bond of order 1.4. We understand it in quantum mechanical detail. It's slow. This protein has one proline in it. So for 30% of the molecules in the unfolded state, that proline's wrong. So one of the two exponents is just that proline flipping and is really dull. And I give you an hour-long seminar on it, but I don't want to.
Can you just repeat what you said about the far UVCD, the near UVCD,
the swap they probe? So this is probing the chirality of the backbone, so primarily looking at whether or not the backbone's forming when helices and beta sheets are forming. This is the packing of aromatic side chains into asymmetric chiral environments. So this is a really excellent probe of the native state, because it's when all of the side chains are packed in there like in a jigsaw puzzle. I'll give you a, remind me, Tom, I'll give you a review of all of our techniques if you'd like.
Just for reference, what you have here, I guess, basically is that the secondary structure is forming on the same time scale as the...
It's exactly what I was trying to say. Everything fault forms on the same time frame.
And just for reference, how would those differ in time for a typical system?
So for that, the previous slide I showed you... That's probably about right. Yeah, two orders of magnitude. Well, actually, all right. Formation of local structure in these experiments is actually formation of helices is a tens of nanoseconds process. Formation of beta hairpins is a few microseconds, and then these collapse events are in the tens of milliseconds. And folding can often be hundreds of milliseconds. So local structure formation is in general very fast. They're just not stable with this protein, with these smaller proteins.
Do those same thin plots like the protein you just showed?
Lysozyme. Lysozyme. They look like that. Kind of. They're very non-exponential. Right? They have a very fast phase and then a slower phase. For lysozyme. Turns out there's some intermediate with too much secondary structure. So it forms excess secondary structure and then it lost as the native phase. Yeah. So I only write down on the board because I just got into an argument with a referee about 6 months ago about whether or not lysozyme forms or an intermediate. Well, there kind of must be an intermediate if the curve goes down and then up. It's sort of a no-brainer. We did win the argument. Yeah. Really? Yeah. Fortunately, I'm not. Where was I? I was going to show you lots of other evidence, but instead I'm not. I'm just going to tell you, we have tried really hard to look to find those intermediates. These things don't appear to state because we're not looking hard enough. And those intermediates are all really high in energy. We know that for a fact. We also know, actually, that this is a general phenomenon. Right? The first protein that behaved that way was reported a little over 10 years ago. Since then, there have been reports of about over three dozen in the literature. They tend to be all of the smallest proteins. Any protein under about 120 amino acids folds in with these two-state kinetics. Any protein with more than 120 amino acids folds in the hierarchical process with well-formed intermediates. Very good rule of thumb with one or two violations in either direction.
The small proteins are actually folding much more slowly than the larger ones, right? That is an excellent question. It was like 200 seconds, right? It was very long.
That was the second slowest two-state folding protein under conditions that slowed it down even more than it would be in water. Mm-hmm. So in general, the smaller proteins fold. There's some overlap. The fastest folding proteins are the smallest ones, but the slowest folding of the small ones folds more slowly than the fastest folding of the multi. Good question.
You just made the really naive estimate again of the 10 to the 40 or whatever for the small molecule. How far off is it?
Oh, still way.
Still.
You still got nine configurations for amino acids, and the smallest proteins are 55, so 9 to the 50th power. Sorry, the smallest are in the 40s, so 9 to the 40th power.
Okay.
Good question, but good try, but no.
This question of how fast does the protein fold, though, is obviously in these two state things extremely ill-defined because it's exponentially dependent on the barrier height. Mm-hmm. The barrier height is probably very sensitive depending on temperature, salt conditions, quality of this.
I used to worry about that a lot. So Tom's pointing out that right, kinetics are sensitive to everything. It turns out they're not very sensitive to it. So 5-10 degree temperature change changes folding rates by a factor of 2 or 3. Change in pH of several units changes folding by a factor of 2 or 3. It's relatively hard to change folding by more than an order of magnitude. And remember, we're looking for 50 order of magnitude effect.
Is that because the kinetics are sensitive to entropy rather than
Well, we'll get back to that. I think that's a telling thing. Is hey, we're onto something, aren't we? Gosh,
we are.
Well, okay, I've already solved it. I'll show you how. All right, where are we? So here is all of protein folding for you in one slide. Big proteins tend to fold through well-formed intermediates. We understand sort of this hierarchical pruning of the search that speeds things up. Small proteins, that hierarchical structure formation is invisible because all the intermediates are high in energy. So A, it's a little hard to see how they guide things, but B, it's really hard to study them, right? I mean, as an experimental biophysicist, I was trained to use my time-resolved spectroscopic tools to characterize these guys. And I can't here because every probe I throw at these gives me the same result. They all tell me the rate of jumping over the one single barrier.
So the big arrow on the right is not equivalent to one of the little arrows on the left?
Let's talk about that at the end. We've been wondering that too, and there's not an obvious answer to it. So when we realized this, we were faced with a juncture. Well, these guys, it's sort of obvious how to study them, if you will. Very much less obvious for us how to study these. So we could have just ignored these and hoped they'd go away, but it turns out that first result was definitive. There are quite a few of them. And in reality, actually, I was attracted to these. What Tom didn't mention, I don't think, in my introduction is that I used to be a theorist. Pardon? Or a simulator. Feels like a AA meeting, isn't it? I am a theorist. And so once you're a theorist, you're always a theorist, right? I am a theorist. Where was I? I don't remember why I said that, except I'm sure I will make fun of theorists even more in this talk. And so I am a card-carrying theorist. I am allowed to. These had a lot of appeal to me, though, because these are the simplest proteins, right? These are the small proteins. If ever the underlying physics is going to be most apparent in they should be most obvious here. If there is any universal underlying physics unfolding, it should be most apparent in these. But of course, we're stuck. We can't use direct experimental probes to figure out what's going on because all of our probes tell us the same thing. So we chose an indirect approach. Instead of asking, specifically what's the mechanism, we decided to ask, why is it that some of these proteins fold more rapidly than others? It's rather a time-honored tradition in chemistry to do that, right? Mechanistic chemists characterize mechanisms all the time that don't go through well-populated intermediates. They do it by synthesizing a set of reactants that are all very similar and react them through the same pathway and then ask which ones are more reactive than others. And what does that tell us about the mechanism? Now, it made us think that was a reasonable approach. In folding kinetics is that if you look at these 36 simple proteins, the fastest of them folds a million times faster than the slowest. So y'all know, by the way, our shorthand, our protein chemist shorthand. In reality, proteins are folded proteins very compact. It's got a density very similar to the density of a crystal of crystal of methanol or so. So if I were to show you these in all atom detail, structure of protein in all atom detail, it just looks like a little rock. Here I've taken away all of the side chain atoms and just shown you in general what the backbone of the polymer is doing. All right, so again, the question I want to address is why is it that this folds a million times more slowly than this protein?
What's the thing in the middle?
Oh, this particular protein is a cytochrome. It's a heme, so a prosthetic group with an iron in it. It turns out that's not particularly significant to the story.
What's the very slow one then?
This is muscle acyl phosphatase. It's a small enzyme. This is 98 amino acids. This is 108. Shows you that it's not length. And in fact, there is no length dependence. If we look across these 36 proteins spanning a million-fold range of rates, there is no correlation with their size and their folding rates. Other than this rule of thumb, things over 120 fold through intermediates, things less, tend not to.
Is there a correlation with percent of alpha helix?
I'll get back to that. Sure is here, isn't there? In fact, I'd say the correlation coefficient's about 1. All right. Well, this approach requires that we rely on our theory brethren. Unfortunately, there are a lot of theorists in folding kinetics, as Tom mentioned. And so we need some theoretical model of why it is one protein might fold faster than another, and see if we can use the relative folding rates of real proteins to tease apart the test and see which of these models is valid, if any. Now, the vast majority of the theoretical literature in my field is based on the simulations of protein folding. Unfortunately, however, until recently, we've never been able to simulate folding in all atom detail. It's a computationally overwhelming problem. Folding rates are slow. Proteins have a lot of atoms in them. So we can address that problem by either simplifying the description of the protein, for instance, by taking a single monomer in the polymer and modeling it as if it were just a single bead instead of 50 atoms. Or we can simplify the dynamics. Instead of doing molecular dynamics in continuum space, we could just do Monte Carlo dynamics on discrete points in a lattice. Or we can do both. And in fact, that's the predominant, from my reading of the literature, that's the predominant approach for theorists of protein folding. They don't study protein folding per se. They study the folding of lattice polymers. Now, these lattice polymers, right, have simplified both the description of the protein and the description of the dynamics. Nonetheless, these things, they do share some potentially important properties with proteins. They are sequence-specific heteropolymers that can be encoded such that they can be given potentials such that they encode a unique ground state. You can get 10,000 lattice polymer sequences that all encode the same structure. And of these 10,000, some will fold to it rapidly and some will fold to it slowly. So they also have this kinetic paradox, if you will. And thus, the thought is that if we understand what it is that separates a rapidly folding lattice polymer sequence from a slowly folding lattice polymer sequence, we'll understand what separates a rapidly folding protein from a slowly folding protein. I've listed three criterion that these various... Well, sorry, when I read the theoretical literature, it looks to me like the community is broken up into three camps, as they all agree that of 10,000 sequences that encode a given fold, some fold fast, some fold slowly. They disagree vehemently on what the criteria are that separate the rapidly folding ones from the slowly folding ones, and they break into three camps I've listed here. But I'll go into this in more detail from my perspective now as an experimentalist. So the first one I'm going to mention wasn't the first chronologically. Tom, you were asking me about Karplus's work a moment ago. So this was put forth by Eugene Shaknevich and Martin Karplus and their student Andre Sali. What they noticed was that in order to ensure that your lattice polymer folds rapidly, you only need a single thing. What you need is for there to be a very large gap between the energy of the single lowest energy conformation, the native state, the folded state, and the energy of the second lowest energy conformation. Right, that this is a necessary and sufficient condition to ensure rapid folding. Well,
the word rapid doesn't have a notation there. Is that really what they say?
That's correct. Basically, yeah. It's always a problem of pulling quotes out of people's papers, right? In this paper, folding meant folding rapidly. Because the ones without an energy gap folded slowly is to not fold at all in their simulations. All right, fair enough. The problem with this hypothesis, though, is, at least from my perspective as a reformed theorist, i.e. an experimentalist, is that this is not a falsifiable hypothesis. Because this energy gap does not correspond to any macroscopic experimental observable. It is the gap in energy between a single conformation and a second conformation. I can't measure that, right? I can measure an ensemble average for the unfolded state relative to the folded state. But I cannot measure the energy of two configurations. That's one problem with it. Actually, there's a long list of problems. That's the one I usually give your more sophisticated audience. I'll also point out it's a little hard to see how a gap, it's easy to see how you could get a gap on in lattice space, but in continuum space, it's a little bit harder to see how you might get a gap, how you define it. And that's, to the best of my knowledge, never been addressed in the literature. So we're going to reject this as unfalsifiable.
Sorry, a question which maybe it's just a silly question, or maybe it's just a can of worms that it's better not get into. But you're using interchangeably native states with lowest free energy.
Good question.
And I'm really, I'm particularly troubled by that, given the combination of this astronomical number for exploring time for exploring all the phase space, together with this hierarchical.
So for the lattice problem,
In these over 20, over 120 or whatever size systems that fold hierarchically, given that and how long it would take to actually explore all the phase space, why should I believe that free energy has...
Absolutely fair point. That is the native state the lowest energy state? Certainly in the lattice polymers, we can look at them exhaustively, and we know that there is a single unique lowest energy state. For real proteins, there are a couple of examples of proteins that fold to very deep kinetic minima, that where the native state or the active state, the biologically relevant state, is not the lowest energy state. We know that's true for a couple of proteins. Do we know it's true? Is that same thing true for other proteins? How can we tell? We can get a feel for it, and my own feel is that the native state probably is the ground state, because we can unfold from completely different, we can refold from completely different unfolded ensembles, and we always get to the same point.
Even so.
No, maybe wrong.
You've got rapidly forming secondary structure that gets in the way of the path to something.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. We do not know that the native state is the ground, is the lowest energy state, is the ground state for real proteins. It's somewhat irrelevant, though, because it's a single state. And we're searching through the ensemble to find a single state.
Sure, but this kind of picture clearly begs that sort of a question.
All right. You know, I hadn't thought of that before, but I must admit, I hadn't thought of that one before. So that's yet another reason why we should be a little distrustful about whether or not lattice polymers really reflect the behavior of proteins. I agree with that.
I'm sorry, I thought reading those papers, my impression was that the idea was that the reason you needed this deep minimal was because you wanted only one stable state. And it really didn't say very much about the time scale, just the fact that there was only one. And if you had this gap, then you would have multiple ground states, and therefore you wouldn't have this uniqueness problem.
Yeah, that's true.
It had little to do with the kinetics. It had mostly to do with the fact that without this picture, you couldn't get...
I think, yes, you are absolutely right. If you don't have if the native state is not a distinct minimum, then you're going to be on some rough landscape where there'll be lots of kinetic traps. That's absolutely true.
Just the fact that you won't have a unique function, you won't have a unique form.
Large
fraction minimum, you need almost all these proteins to make exactly the same state, so they do their biology.
That's right. Functionally, you want the native state to be a minimum, or deep well, so that everything goes into it, and so you get your maximum efficiency. That's true, but also there's this kinetic issue. If you've got other low-lying states that are nearby, those could be traps that prevent you from getting to this correct native state. All of these issues are true, but actually this group has, to my reading of their papers, has repeatedly stated that no, just this gap alone is sufficient to ensure rapid kinetics, which, actually, look, there's lots and lots of reasons why that's BS. I wasn't going to go into here. The reason I'm not going to go into it here is because even if it wasn't BS, it's not something I can test as an experimentalist. And back when I was a theorist, I was taught that if it's not falsifiable, it's not really a theory, but that's neither here nor there, I guess. So let's just abandon that one.
Certainly counterexample.
I don't see David Gross, so I'll... Well, never mind. I love chatting with Tony Z about whether aesthetic appeal is sufficient. All right. Second hypothesis that I'm going to discuss, but really the first one that was put forth, was that in order to ensure rapid folding, There's a lot of non-native English speakers in our field, and good folding sequence, that is, as rapidly folding sequences have a weakly rugged funnel-like landscape. Actually, this audience might understand that when I speak to that, when I show this to normal audiences. I told you I was going to be obnoxious today. I have to quickly point out, really conceptually, I mean, linguistically that's hard to parse, but conceptually it's fairly straightforward. All right, here's an energy landscape. Energy is, as you step through the different configurations, the protein can take on. And there's no correlation here. As you get closer to the native state, you don't, the energy doesn't drop down. But what they saw with these groups, and these groups being Peter Walness was the first, and Jose Onacek took this up in a big way. What they saw was that for the rapidly folding lattice polymer sequences, that there was a bias. As you got closer to the native state, the energy dropped, right? So it's sort of a directed process. Now, this is the energy of each individual configuration. As you get down this well, though, the number of configurations that are down here is lessened, and so there can still be a barrier here, right, because there's an entropic bottleneck.
So this is not the free energy.
That's right. This is every aspect of the free energy except the configurational entropy, which was why, remember, I couldn't falsify the energy gap hypothesis, because it's the same thing. I measure free energy. They're talking about some property I can't measure. They're talking about that same property here. This is the so-called funnel hypothesis. Many of you have probably heard of. Now, once again, I can't.
How can they tell how weak convolutions are close to each other?
Well, so Tony, that's the question of, in chemist language, what's a good reaction coordinate for this? And oh my God, I don't even want to go there. But imagine there's some magical reaction coordinate about which this is true. Now, there almost certainly isn't one in one dimension.
It's very high. I always think that there's some way to get at it.
Remind me before you leave beautiful Santa Barbara, I have a paper on that too. Remind me to give it to you. That is a test of a good reaction coordinate is whether when you measure diffusion rates over it, does it get you the proper rate out? And recently, Vijay Ponzi and I showed that even when you get the proper rate out, that doesn't tell you anything about what the mechanism is, what the actual path is. Any rate. So once again, this is sort of untestable because this energy does not correspond to something I can observe experimentally. It's not testable in a global way, but it is testable in at least sort of a smaller way, because these landscapes are still not perfectly smooth. There's some energetic roughness or energetic frustration, as that community calls it. Right? There's some overall bias to the native state, but in addition to this bias, the overall bias has to be large relative to roughness on the landscape, so things don't get trapped. Or that's how they would put it. How I would put it was that the energy landscape has to be smooth relative to KT, right? Otherwise you're going to get trapped. And that's something that I can explore experimentally because, right, KT is an experimental variable, at least the T part of it is, to some extent. All right, so how do I look for that roughness? Well, as we lower the temperature, that roughness will start to crop up in what's referred to as the glass transition temperature. Oh my God, you guys know way more about glass transition temperatures than I do. Not usually true for my normal audiences. Now remember, we're talking about a kinetic process, though. I always get a little confused about how this might be mappable onto the issue of glass transitions in bulk polymers, but Tom's just shaking his head sadly. Anyway, but you can imagine, as we lower the temperature, those little barriers will start to loom large relative to KT, and they'll start tugging away at the kinetics. What these groups found was that in order to ensure rapid folding, there has to be there's some characteristic temperature, equilibrium temperature, at which the thing folds, period, an equilibrium property, that is greater than this glass transition temperature, this temperature in which the local minima start to dominate the process and make folding arbitrarily slow. And again, for what they saw was that for their rapidly folding lattice polymer sequences, this glass transition temperature is fairly significantly below that characteristic folding temperature for the polymer. Now, again, I claim that as an experimentalist I can test this. To test it, I need to figure out how I'm going to observe TG. I'm going to observe TG when the kinetics switch, right? This is, if it's a two-state process with a single barrier, I get exponential kinetics. But as those local minima start to tug away at the process, the kinetics become stretched. And you don't have to go all the way to the glass transition temperature to see that stretching. At the glass transition temperature, folding is arbitrarily slow. But as we get close to the glass transition temperature, the stretching exponential should start to become measurable. Now, there's some serious debate in the literature about how close to TG we need to be before the stretching gets big enough. But in general, you see, we're going to look for we're going to lower the temperature, we're going to look for deviations from non-single exponential kinetics.
Okay, well, there are two things here. There's the stretching bit, and there's the just rate as well. And you should see something enormously slow down at the rate. They're really near real TG.
Yeah.
The same point here, I mean, you've got non-single exponential kinetics for
lots of
reasons, particularly in
systems. Well, okay, Tom's got an excellent point. You can see non-single exponential kinetics for lots of reasons. And as you lower the temperature, the folding rate, right, there's an exponential temperature dependence. There's a viscosity dependence, which is also temperature dependent. The pre-exponential is temperature dependent. The exponential is temperature dependent. There are lots of reasons things are temperature dependent. You lower the temperature, you'll get slower kinetics, even if you've got just a single barrier. But if you've got lots and lots of little barriers that start to loom large, you will also get these deviations from non-single exponential kinetics. Now, as Tom pointed out, there are other reasons you can get deviations from non-single exponential kinetics, experimental error being my favorite. These are not easy experiments to do, because error always makes things go away from single exponential kinetics, not to single exponential kinetics. There are actually a number of reports in the literature of non-single exponential kinetics done by laser T-jump experiments. But remember, a laser T-jump experiment, you've got a laser that's heating a sample. You can get heterogeneities in the heating. You get heterogeneities in the cooling, etc., etc., etc. Gosh, they saw non-single exponential kinetics. What if we do these rapid mixing experiments, which are enormously more stable than T-jump experiments? That's one thing. So one thing we want to do, we want to get rid of every non-energy landscape reason for non-single exponential kinetics. So the first thing we do is we look for a simple protein. Remember, I mentioned prolines. Prolines have this cis-trans isomerization that's very slow. So if you have prolines in your protein, your unfolded state is heterogeneous, and you will get non-single exponential kinetics. So we found prolines are common. We found a protein that lacks them. And we looked at its folding kinetics. Well, here are the folding kinetics at the temperature at which this protein evolved. Right? At the temperature at which evolution cares about folding and presumably would have selected for a sequence that folds well. And right, single exponential fit, the residual amplitudes are less than 1%. Serial correlation of the amplitude is trivial. There's no information content in the amplitude. This is single exponential. Oh, and when we fit to stretch exponential, we get a stretching factor with an error of unity. But hey, this is where evolution cares about it, right? So you might expect it to be non-glassy there. Where should it be glassy? Well, here, this is an equilibrium experiment. We've thermally unfolded the protein. Here's that characteristic folding temperature. My PhD is in biology. I refuse to use Kelvin. Although you all understand that really I've got to convert to Kelvin to do all of this. There's the characteristic folding temperature. Remember, for the rapidly folding lattice polymers, there's some ratio of this temperature to the glass temperature. So that suggests if this protein's acting like the rapidly folding lattice polymers, that glass transition temperature should be somewhere below the freezing point of water.
Pardon?
This?
You measure the fraction.
This one was done by circular dichroism, but any biophysical probe will give us the same measure. Their equilibrium folding is also too sting.
But in the beginning of the talk, you said different measures tell you about the creation of secondary structure.
Yeah.
So this measure is of the tertiary structure.
This was far UV, so it's secondary structure. Oh. But I assure you that if we'd done any other probe, it would have given us the same.
Oh, okay.
Because the kinetics of these are two-state. Also, the equilibrium folding is two-state. We're going to get back to that, too. No. It's a 62 amino acid single domain protein locking prolines. I don't remember anything else. So again, so we're going to lower the temperature, we're going to look at the glass transition temperature. Again, we don't have to get down to here to see the glass transition. We just need to get close to that and we'll start to see the stretching, right?
Okay.
Now, there's a problem here, though, right? Everybody said KT is a variable, experimentally addressable variable. To some degree, proteins only fold in liquid water, though. So we have to put in antifreezes, right? And so for rapidly folding lattice polymer sequences, the ratio of this number to TG is 1.6.
Yeah, so yeah. Just taking
75
plus 300
bump. Yeah, plus 273. Exactly. Now, of course, maybe these are better than the lattice polymers, and so maybe TG is lower. And I mean, there's got to be a TG somewhere. If we were able to fold a protein in liquid water at a tenth of a Kelvin, I think local barriers would loom large relative to KT, right?
So this protein folds when you heat it?
No, this is... you're the first person to ever notice that mistake. And it's like, I've been showing this for about a year and a half, so this should be fraction unfolded. Remind me to give Blake a hard time. I've really given this talk 15 times. I've shown this talk 15 or 20 times. No one's ever been as impolite enough to show this. Yeah?
It's funny that you don't know that, but TM is what we call TM.
That's right. We experimentalists call this the melting temperature, and the theorists call it the folding temperature. And as one of the few people at the interface, I'm kind of schizophrenic about it. All right. So we can lower the temperature by adding antifreezes. The lowest temperature we can get in the laboratory in our apparatus is 15 degrees below the freezing point of water, because when we try to go lower, we break a $2,000 quartz cuvette. It's different being an experimentalist. Here are our data. All right, it's fit to a single exponential with a sloping baseline. There's some instrument artifacts. There's some information content, right? Now, it turns out the residuals fit a sine wave with a period of 49.95 hertz. The instrument was built in your country, Tom. Right?
So the
engineers at the company swear if it's running on 60 hertz here, it should be 60 hertz, and there's nothing in it. But that can't be a coincidence. And it's just a sine wave. We see no... But even ignoring that, we fit this to a stretch exponential and we get a stretching parameter with an error of unity. There's no stretching here. Lowest temperature we can go, still no stretching. So that says that the glass transition temperature is at least 45. But remember, it's not clear how close you have to be to the glass transition temperature to see the stretching. The theorists don't agree. So we know that it's at least 45 or maybe more than 100 degrees below the freezing point of water. It's really low is the point. Much lower than you would expect based on the lattice polymer studies. So...
If you tried one of these systems that had folding and count for it as an exponential plus the stress.
Yeah.
Obviously, then you have small play in where TG would be for a given system.
But still, we can do it. And in fact, I'm not even going to show you the data on that. So, yeah, that was the next thing I was going to talk about. So, all right, theory's right. The energy landscape is smooth. The glass transition temperature is so low we cannot measure it. So to that extent, theory is correct. But these same theorists, in their lattice polymer simulations, what they find is that sometimes things fold slowly because the glass transition temperature is relatively high. And even this is the only protein we've got with no prolines in it, but proteins with prolines we just put in two or three exponentials and we still see no stretching. So we see, while it is true that the glass transition temperature is low, it's unmeasurably low for every protein we've looked at. Differences in this glass transition temperature are not why some small proteins fold a million times faster than another.
How much does this slow down relative to the higher temperature when you factor out
actually, ironically, this is just about as fast as the faster one. There's yet another issue. So folding rates depend upon how stable the protein is under the given conditions. And ethylene glycol and almost all, in fact, and all antifreezes greatly stabilize proteins. So this protein is way more stable under these conditions than at the higher temperatures. And that stabilization speeds things up by the expected amount. So we didn't really slow things down.
So, in other words, when you account for the viscosity change, which will slow things down, and the additional stability of that.
Which speeds them up.
Speeds them up, it seems like it comes out about where it should.
That's right.
Doesn't have any effect of the ruggedness of the landscape.
No, that's right. That's right. The landscape is smooth relative to KT at the lowest temperatures we can get to. And that's true for every one of these proteins that we've looked at, spanning a good chunk of this million-fold range of folding rates. So, again, theory's right. The energy landscape should be smooth to ensure rapid folding. Great. To the extent that it said it, theory is wrong in saying that maybe differences in the glass transition temperature are why one protein folds faster than another. That was my real take-home message from that rather long.
Sorry. If there is a barrier, the energy transition state, the free energy dominated by entropy. That's what this is saying. I have to think about that.
For me, this is just saying that there's only one barrier.
Yeah, but I mean, factoring out, where you could do an Arrhenius plot.
Oh yeah, yeah, we do Arrhenius plots with a correction for the fact that the stability of the native state changes a function of temperature. So Arrhenius plots are curved because there's a big heat capacity change. Correct for the heat capacity change, Arrhenius plots are dead on straight.
But the energy you get to do that is far smaller than any potential candidate for the real,
yes, that's
free
right.
energy barrier.
That's right, that's right. So there's a small enthalpic barrier, but it is small. All right, Dan, we're down to... Well, I'm sorry, what time is it?
It's now 25 past 11, but we started a bit late. And these things go on until 12.
Or until I collapse. Actually, I'm doing well. All right, well, one more parameter that I'm going to rush to fairly quickly then. So there's this third camp that's kind of a lonely camp. There's really only one person in it, but he's rather vociferous and publishes a lot. Dave Thermal at University of Maryland. Dave spends a lot of time here at the ICP. In Dave's hands, the parameter, the equilibrium parameter that separates rapidly folding lattice polymer and off-lattice models from solely folding models is this dimensionless parameter he calls sigma. All right, and don't even read that. Don't even read that. I'll show you graphically. Much easier. Imagine you've got some unfolded polypeptide in a good solvent. My normal audiences don't know that phrase. All right, unfolded polypeptide in a good solvent. You start to decrease the solvent quality, and right, you go through some theta point eventually. Right, non-specific monomer-monomer interactions start to dominate, and the chain should collapse to a globule. That's potentially different than folding, right? Folding isn't so much a non-specific collapse, but a highly specific crystallization event. And you might imagine that folding would occur under different solvent conditions than collapse does. And what Dave noted was that the thing that separates the rapidly folding lattice polymer, rapidly folding simple models from the slowly folding simple models, is that for the slowly folding ones, there's a big gap between these two. And sigma is a relative measure of the size of the gap, right? The size of the gap over that value.
So how do you distinguish, how do you do the experiment that will collapse the protein but not...
How do we measure it experimentally?
So how do you separate the specific from non-specific?
I'll show you. Well, actually, what I'm going to show you is that we don't necessarily need to so much, but...
Right. The last problem is what's some sort of solvent quality effect with it?
Well, no, there he's going against, or they're lowering the temperature, and so the entropic desire to be expanded starts to lose out over the non-specific monomer-monomer interactions. So it's not a solvent one. But he's done off-lattice ones with implicit solvent, too, and gets the same effect.
So if I understand correctly, the idea is sort of that the collapse happens first and then...
Well, this is an equilibrium, property. That seems to be correlated. Now here are theoretical results that I just shamelessly stole from one of David's papers. So different folding rates for different lattice polymers, and then different measures of this equilibrium property sigma, and he sees some correlation between the two. And then so it's an sort of empirical observation for lattice polymers that then you can put your mechanistic idea on top of, right? Okay, and you see, right, to get a good size change. Here, to get a 10,000-fold change in folding rates, sigma needs to change quite a bit. Remember, it can only range from 0 to 1, so you need to go from 0 to 0.5 to get a 4-order of magnitude change in folding rates. Again, this is something that I can test experimentally. I can monitor folding using a near UV CD. That's the packing of aromatic side chains. It's a very authentic measure of actually honest to God folded state. By the way, I did get Dave Thermally to agree with me on all these things before we did the experiments. And then I can measure collapse by doing small angle X-ray scattering. Now, the collapse state is going to have a mixture in it. It's going to see non-specific collapse and it's going to see folded. But if non-specific collapse is occurring at a different solvent conditions than folding, I still should get the curve shifted. But then you see, for this protein, the curves aren't shifted. Sigma is within error of zero. So for this protein, as we change solvent conditions, collapse and folding are synonymous. Actually, we're just about to try and measure the theta point. Basically, sigma, I think in reality, sigmas are negative. Right? The non-specific collapse is occurring somewhere over here. It's just that it folds before it non-specifically collapses. And Bill Eaton at NIH has just got first hints that that's true. Maybe something worthy of looking at from the theoretical perspective. Anyway, cytochrome C, though, is a really rapidly folding protein. And so maybe we should expect the sigma to be small. So we've looked now at a number of proteins spanning a four order of magnitude range of rates. Now remember, so that's theory. Theory says you need a big change in sigma to change rates by four orders of magnitude. And there's the experiment. I am just as obnoxious when I haven't taken any Valium before the talk. I don't really mean to be so well, and they're all within error of zero. So again, I mean, on the one hand, theory's right. Sigmas of zero are associated with rapid folding. On the other hand, theory is wrong. Differences in sigma do not account for why some proteins fold fast, some naturally occurring proteins fold faster than others. Well, you know, when I started this, I started talking about three different criterion. Unmeasurable, but we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. We'll say, okay, sure, these things have big gaps. Low glass transition temperature, it's so low we can't measure it for any of the proteins we've looked at. It's probably exceedingly low for all of these small proteins. And sigma zero for every protein we've looked at. And for everyone, there are data in the literature that we can reinterpret this way. Every protein has a sigma zero, almost everyone. Well, okay, so these are naturally occurring proteins. If evolution cares about folding kinetics, maybe it's going to want to optimize all of these. So maybe that's why all of these are optimal. Now, that still doesn't explain why some proteins fold faster than others. Wasn't that the title when I talk, why my protein folds faster than yours? It would be disappointing if I stopped here, wouldn't it? But actually, we do have a theory as to why some proteins fold faster than others. But before I launch into that, I want to show you one other slide that relates to these issues. So again, these are all naturally occurring proteins, and all the criterion that theorists have put forth to explain why naturally occurring proteins fold rapidly happen to be true for all the naturally occurring proteins. Now, historically, that was the only thing we experimentalists could test, because we didn't have unnaturally occurring proteins. Well, that's changed in the last few years. A number of groups have come up with computer algorithms that allow them to design proteins de novo. These proteins, these algorithms don't care one whit about folding kinetics. They only care about properly packing in amino acid side chains. We've been collaborating with Steve Mayo's group down at Caltech looking at some of those proteins. Here's some fairly recent results. So Steve took the homeodomain backbone, this known topology, this known sequence, redesigned half of it, just the core. I think it was the core. So here's a variant where they've changed 45% of the amino acids in it with an algorithm that doesn't care about kinetics. Another variant where they've changed more than 70% of the residues using an algorithm that does not care about kinetics, folding rate of the wild type, folding rate of this one. The folding rate of this one we haven't even measured yet. It's too fast. So these criterion are probably true for this protein too, even though evolution didn't play any role in it, even though these proteins are generated with an algorithm that doesn't care about kinetics. So, please.
If I'm understanding this right, it seems like all the sort of theoretical proposals you've said have sort of been related to equilibrium properties, right?
Yeah.
So what if it's I mean, has anyone proposed that something non-equilibrium, like, so for example, like hydrodynamic interactions that,
Yeah, people have shied away from that for a lot of reasons. None of them ever explicitly stated. The one I usually think of is that the dynamics of a lattice polymer are probably very different than the dynamics of a continuum protein in real solution. Another reason, maybe a more philosophical one, but actually one that I think would hit home with the experimental community that's supposed to be their audience, is that anyone can relate folding kinetics to a kinetic property. Right, what we want to do is find some equilibrium property of this sequence that ensures that its kinetics are rapid. Anyway, that's just my take on it. So while I believe all those criteria are important, they seem to be easy to generate. You can generate them for a given topology. You can generate them without even thinking about it. And again, they don't seem to account for why one protein folds faster than another.
The different folded states of these different artificially engineered sequences, are they completely different?
No. We don't know in great detail the structure of these twos, it's fairly clear they're almost identical. So it may be, and in fact, no one has come up. Well, people have just come up with the design algorithms that will design a sequence that will fold to some known topology, some known overall global structure. No one has published a design algorithm that allows people to build a new topology. So all of these properties may be a function of naturally occurring global topologies. So right now all I can say is for a naturally occurring topology, it's very easy to get a rapidly folding sequence for it. That may not be true for non-naturally occurring topologies. And there's a big theory group at the NEC that they've done some neat simulations that suggest that some topologies, that it's very easy to get sequences that fold rapidly to them, and for other topologies, there are other low-lying states, so the landscape's glassy. So it may be true that for all naturally occurring structures, that their landscapes just aren't glassy. But again, none of this explains why some proteins fold faster than others. No, again, for these small proteins, the size range is from about 41 to... For these two-state folding proteins, they range in size from about 41 residues to 154. And across that factor of 4 length scale, there is zero correlation with length. All right. Jumping back to the slide, we've got these criteria that seem to be true for all naturally occurring proteins. They seem to be true for design proteins. They're all kind of saying the same thing, aren't they? They're all saying that folding is very cooperative, right? Energy gap is sort of an all or none process. Native state's very unique. Low glass transition temperature, you've got some native state, you don't have a lot of other traps. Native state's unique. Sigma zero, there aren't collapsed states that are stable relative to the native state, as you were implying, I think. All of these are saying that folding is cooperative. And that's true. What we know is, what's known is that if you take one of these small proteins and you cut 2 or 3 or 4 amino acids away from either end, they completely unfold. So here are a couple of examples from the literature. These are the sequence lengths of the folded proteins. You trim them by a few residues at either end, and they totally unfold. Totally unfold. They go random
across. Arbitrary residues?
They're at the ends, but I don't think there's anything special about the ends. If you cut residues out of the middle, though, you then kind of have to stretch the things together, and so then maybe you wouldn't be surprised that that doesn't fold, right? Lop off the middle and pull the ends together, you're totally screwing things up. If you just trim a few from the end.
But the question is where they are, those ends, and the collapse state. Is there in the middle?
For all of these, the ends are at the surface. And in general, ends are at the surface because the terminal residues have charges. This is fairly general. Here's some results that were collected last night, I think. I told the student I really wanted this before today's talk. These are NMR data for a 55 residue protein. This is the these are the resonances where the protons attach to the nitrogens in the backbone crop up. And in a folded protein, you get lots of dispersion, because in a folded protein, the different amino acids are in very different environments. You remove four residues from the C-terminus of this, and you notice the spectrum is just completely collapsed. Notice the signal to noise is also a bit different. It's not terribly soluble because it's unfolded. But you remove four residues. You removed less than 10% of the sequence, and it has gone random coil. Proteins are unique, I think, in that way. Their folding is, actually, I'm desperately searching for a better phrase for this. I call it hyper-cooperative. Right? But it's really all or none. You have to have 90 or 95% of the native structure before delta G drops below zero. Which kind of explains why the energy landscape's smooth, I think. You don't have misfolded, no partially folded states are stable. And probably no misfolded states are going to be stable. All right. This cooperativity is critical. I think this cooperativity also starts to explain why it is some proteins fold faster than others. Or at least we have a theory as to why some of these small proteins fold faster than others that's based on this issue that this hyper-cooperativity is universal. So it's based on that one observation. One, 90% of the structure has to be there before delta G drops below zero. Another observation it's based on is that someone was asking, is local structure formation is very rapid. Helices form in tens of nanoseconds. Beta hairpins form in microseconds. Loops close in tens of nanoseconds. Local structures are formed many, many, many orders of magnitude more rapidly than folding. Now, folding's hypercooperative. So while these local structures for these small proteins can form extremely rapidly, they're unstable unless 90% of the structure is there. And so they break even more rapidly than they form. So that gives us an image of folding, right? This is about iteration number three. We're going to need some more iterations to get this figure perfect, but let's see, we have unfolded states. Well, here's the native state of a protein. Here's an unfolded molecule. Well, you see, part of the structure is roughly correct. That part can rapidly zipper up and form that beta hairpin. It takes a microsecond to do that. But this state, right, the chain's twisting around in the wrong direction, it can't go any farther. The zippering can't go any farther. This is a partially structured state. It's high in energy. So while it forms in a microsecond, it breaks even faster. Forms, breaks, forms, breaks, forms, breaks. Every once in a while, though, this unfolded state will undergo some huge rearrangement, right? It's a big rearrangement to go from behind there to back over here. You've got some big slow global rearrangements. Every once in a while, you'll get in this something that's crudely got the correct geometry. We refer to that as the native topomer. Once you've got the crude local geometry, then you can support zippering all the way down into the native state, all the way down to that magic point of 90% of the native structure, and be trapped. Okay? Does this make sense relative to the issue that folding is highly cooperative, so partially structured states are unstable, and they're formed and break very fast? And so the rate limiting step we're arguing here is these slow global topological rearrangements. Now, this would predict, then, that the rate-limiting step in folding is related to the probability of finding something with the correct global topology. And if different topologies, well, let's see. Here's something kind of boring that model predicts. One, it says the rate-limiting step involves these huge motions due to solvent, so it should be viscosity-dependent, viscosity folding rate. Unfortunately, kind of almost all models can be made to be viscosity dependent, though. So, someone had to do that, right? All right. But it's also predicting, though, it's also kind of telling us why maybe one protein might fold faster than another. Right? Some topologies, some geometries are going to be easier to find than other geometries.
And if suggesting the fluxes model.
Oh, no, no, unrelated. You digest the end and you just see the thing unfold at equilibrium. So that data tells you that all of these partially structured states are high in energy. So it doesn't. This model doesn't tell us about the digestion. The digestion tells us about this model. Right? Because you have to have that digestion intelligence. You have to have 90 to 95% of the structure to be stable. So these guys are not trapped. They form and they break very fast. All right. So,
presumably, you couldn't extract any information from those truncation experiments because any kinetic information because they didn't fold at all.
Yeah.
Are there any truncation proteins that you can get to fold by drawing something and then see what's going
to break? The student who's working on that project, who made that slide last night, is on jury duty this morning. We could ask him. He hasn't done it yet. He will. So there are a number of things that stabilize native states of protein, like sodium sulfate or glycerol. And so we're going to do that. And I think the answer is going to be, once you stabilize them, they fold just about as fast as the wild-type protein did. Because the topology hasn't really changed in a significant way. All right, so this is arguing that topology should matter. And, please.
I was just going to say, do you know how to get from through these steps, and it's still way faster than explosion of phase space.
Yes. What we're arguing is that the rate-limiting step is finding something that's in the native topomer. That is, that the rate-limiting step is getting into a geometry such that every pair of amino acids that are in contact in the native state are close enough that they can move together, that they collide faster than the rate-limiting step. However, the rate-limiting step is slow. So proximity doesn't really mean all that close. So in fact, there's lots and lots. While the number of configurations that are in the native topomer is enormously smaller than the total number of all unfolded configurations, it's also enormously bigger than unity. So that's how we solve with this model this kinetic paradox. Because zippering is fast, then the limiting step is just finding this state that from which it's basically downhill all the way, thermodynamically downhill to the native state. So now we've sort of gone back to this idea of a smooth funnel. So basically we're saying, yeah, okay, fine, this funnel idea might have been right, but the reason that proteins fold with different rates is because getting into the funnel, it's a connected chain. The thing can't cross through itself. Getting into the top of the funnel is the hard part, and then that rapid zippering is after the funnel, we don't see it. All right, so.
This particular one you've shown, I think this is the topomer search becomes a diffusive search in two dimensions only, which is the hinge, which is the beta sheet.
Yeah.
There's one alpha helix and there's a hinge point on the bottom right between that. And all you've got to do is to get that sort of angle right.
That may be true, although you can always, right? I mean, this is an unfolded state, right? This guy could be tucked in there. I mean, there are other complications. By the way, you guys just see the structure? My students, never mind. Inside joke.
Something like a winding number?
Excellent. Excellent point. That's just about where I'm getting to. Not quite that, but just where I'm getting to. All right. This is very perfect. Perfect. Very qualitative, very hand-waving argument here. We potentially could put it on a quantitative footing, right? I'm saying that the rate-limiting step is proportional to the probability of finding this state. Is there some simple mathematical expression that tells me that? At first glance, it might not be so easy, right? It's a set of very complicated conditional probabilities, right? Because we need to bring together, well, what do we need to bring together? We need to bring into proximity any pair of sequence distant residues that are in contact in the native state. We don't care about sequence local interactions. Two residues that are, two amino acids that are five amino acids apart, their positions are correlated anyway. But, so instead we need to figure out how hard it is to get all sequence distant native pairs roughly into proximity. And that is, again, a set of conditional probabilities, right? The probability of bringing these guys together is going to depend critically on whether or not these guys are together. But it turns out, well, we started to tackle this using some Gaussian chain simulations, right? And so on the one hand, this is, oh my God, this is going to be so complicated. On the other hand, this is going to be kind of easy, right? Because I'm arguing that the rate-limiting step is this diffusive, the diffusive motions of an inert polymer. There is no chemistry here. so it should be easy to simulate. So we started to simulate to see if these complicated conditional probabilities collapse, if there's some simple expression that describes the probability of achieving any given configuration. And indeed, we found that to be true. It turns out once you've brought two or three, once you've brought about three sequence distant elements into proximity, then the probability of bringing the next element in, it's about the same as the probability of bringing yet another element in. A mean field approximation starts to work very rapidly. And thus the probability of bringing the entire chain into roughly the correct geometry is simply going to go exponentially with, it's going to be the probability of making one contact, and it's going to go exponentially with the total number of things you need to order. And it turns out there's a little pre-factor of it. But this is a simple model. We can test this experimentally, right? We've got all these small two-state folding proteins. So we go through the three dozen. We call out ones that have the same structure. We don't want to over-represent any given geometry. And we come up with a data set of two dozen unrelated two-state folding proteins of known structure. We go into the known structures, we count how many sequence distant pairs of amino acids interacting, we know the folding rates. Folding rate versus that number, or a linearized version. Now the correlation coefficient there is 0.88. So our R squared is better than 3/4, so we're capturing more than 3/4 of the variance in the data with this simple model. It turns out the residuals here are statistically significantly correlated with length, though. Someone was asking about length. Several people were asking about length. However, they are inversely correlated with length. Longer proteins fold more rapidly than shorter proteins, all other things being equal. I didn't have time to make a copy of that slide. But why is that? We don't have a first principles argument, but we have at least a hand-waving argument. We think it's crowding effects. If you need to make sort of three long-distance interactions over 10 amino acids, well, because of steric effects, because of stiff chain stiffness and excluded volume effects, that's going to be harder than making... Absolutely, it was a Gaussian chain. No stiffness, no excluded volume. So one of these days, we'll get... because the amino acids are discrete?
No, because the larger proteins have domains, right? So
these are all single domain proteins. Okay. If you've got multiple domains, then you get this one folds, this one folds, you get complicated kinetics.
So this is Rao's dynamics.
This is?
Rao's.
I don't know the face. No. So actually, our Gaussian chain simulations, we're looking for an equilibrium property. What's the probability of adopting any given configuration? I think it was local moves, but I don't even remember because it doesn't matter. It was an equilibrium property we were looking for.
That in some sense, you're doing
local moves.
These are actually experimentally observed folding rates, experimentally observed number of long range contacts. Sorry, thank you, I didn't catch that. So it turns out our results are very insensitive to that. We define long range variously as things that are at least anywhere between that cutoff can be between 4 and 12 amino acids, and our results are identical. I think this is 12. And we define interacting as the two C-alpha positions, the central atom in the backbone, being within 8 angstroms of one another. Right? This model says, hey, chemistry doesn't matter, so we ignore side chains. We just say one or two C-alphas. So we're saying whenever we've got two amino acids that are more than 12 amino acids apart in the sequence, and for whose C alphas are within 8 angstroms, that is two long-range sequences and amino acids that are in contact in the native state, must be in proximity in the transition state. We do not know what proximity means. We simply know they have to be in proximity. Thus, folding rates scale exponentially with a number of them. And ultimately, we kind of get an idea of proximity out of the slope here. In general, these are helical proteins, and in general, these are all mixed helix and sheet proteins, right? So for helical proteins, most interactions are sequence local, and thus most positions are highly correlated, and there are few long-range interactions you have to worry about. In fact, this model actually predicts pretty well. Not only does it predict rates, it predicts when it will fail to predict rates. This mean field approximation only works when you've got more than three long-range interactions. We now have folding rates for three proteins that have fewer than three long-range interactions, and this model underestimates their folding rates by one, by at least an order of magnitude, by at least a factor of 20.
Would be correlated with just percentage of alpha helical.
Much, much weaker. In fact, not really statistically significant. I mean, alpha helical content is related to QD, but it's sufficiently weakly related to it that there's no statistically significant correlation with folding rates. It turns out we had discovered, I had discovered when I was a postdoc some years ago, an empirical measure of topology that relates folding rates to structure. It was purely empirical. Since then, about four other purely empirical metrics have come out. So, of course, as always, I was being disingenuous here. We've been wondering for 4 years why the hell it is that topology predicts folding rates. Now I think we understand why it is. And the critical issue is this cooperativity issue. I mean, folding is so hypercooperative that you have to have things roughly correct before you can jump into the native well. And we've figured out how to tabulate the probability of getting things roughly correct.
So the folding kinetics
Folding kinetics are kinetic.
It's waiting to make those long-range contacts.
Well, it's constantly sampling local interactions, but they're breaking even faster than they're sampling. So sample until, oh, hey, suddenly I can sample all the way into the native well, if you will. Where am I?
Well, you're pretty much on the so.
Incredibly fast. No, yes, one issue. Why isn't it that the lattice polymer people didn't discover this? Lattice polymers don't have any topology dependence. This is very ongoing research. This is a 96 3x3x3 Go potential lattice polymer sequences, for those of you who know. Go potential is a very smooth landscape. A measure of topology, log of folding rates, not much of a correlation. The folding of lattice polymers isn't cooperative. You trim off two or three residues from the end, and they're still folded. Lattice polymers are not like proteins in this critical way. But we can make them like proteins. Right, we can, instead of making the energy a linear function of the number of contacts, we can make it some nonlinear, some cooperative function. And we've just started doing that. And these are our very first results. We add just a tiny bit of cooperativity. You know, this is just a tiny bit of cooperativity the first time, but already this is a statistically significant result. This is a correlation coefficient of 0.75.
How did you assert the
I don't remember what the function is, but, you know, we just multiplied the energy by, you know, instead of being a linear function, it's just got a tiny bit of curve. Very little. So we're working on adding more right now. I mean, the simulations are running now. The cooperativity, it's it. That hypercooperativity of proteins is it, I think. It's why proteins behave the way they do. And it's probably what smooths the landscape, as I mentioned, right? If you have to have 90% of the structure there to be stable, then misfolded states are probably going to be unstable, and partially folded states are going to be unstable, and all the traps are going to be unstable. So that's what you want to do. You make things cooperative, you smooth the landscape, you make folding as fast as you can. When you do that, it accidentally becomes topology dependent, and that's why one protein folds faster than another. Great. This doesn't my acknowledgement slide won't impress people here as much as it does when I spoke at Washington University in St. Louis recently. And in fact, this is embarrassingly out of date. My laboratory, some of whom are missing, Dima Makarov, the topo research model I put together before I met you, who's in chemistry here, Dima Makarov is now at UT Austin. And the SAC studies we did at Stanford with Seb Doniak. I'll leave it at that. Thank you, everyone. That was fun.